In Super Manhood, that was the last paragraph, 722 beginning. Okay, Shyam, read this paragraph again.
The spiritual man is the sign of this new evolution, this new and higher endeavor of nature. But this evolution differs from the past process of the evolutionary energy in two respects. It is conducted by a conscious effort of the human mind, and it is not confined to a conscious progression of the surface nature, but is accompanied by an attempt to break the walls of the ignorance and extend ourselves inward into the secret principle of our present being, and outward into cosmic being as well as upward towards a higher principle. Up till now, what nature had achieved was an enlarging of the bounds of our surface knowledge ignorance. What it attempted in the spiritual endeavor is to abolish the ignorance, to go inwards and discover the soul, and to become united in consciousness with God and with all existence. This is the final aim of the mental stage of evolutionary nature and man. It is the initial step towards a radical transmutation of the ignorance into the knowledge. The spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind, an action felt and accepted on the surface. But this by itself can lead only to an illumined mental idealism or to the growth of a religious mind, a religious temperament, and some devotion in the heart and piety in the conduct. It is a first approach of mind to spirit, but it cannot make a radical change. More has to be done. We have to live deeper within. We have to exceed our present consciousness, surpass our present status of nature.
So this paragraph comes at the end of a number of paragraphs which Sri Aurobindo is talking about the mind and its ranges,
its rungs, first establishing the connections with the lower ranges of consciousness through the physical mind and the vital mind, and then the mind proper, which is the mind of pure intelligence, as he calls it, and then pointing to the fact that there is an inner mind or a subliminal mind which opens to higher ranges of mind that are not yet established in the human being. So, Sri Aurobindo has been pointing to the various ranges of mind and the fact that there is an inner mind which opens to higher ranges not yet established in us. And then he's making the point in the paragraph before the one we read that humankind has sort of veered between these already established ranges of the ignorant mind, what we might call the animal humanity. So far, we've moved back and forth and explored in many grooves this old habitual sort of, you know, possibility which is already established in us as mind. But until we move out of this particular realm of physical, vital and mental mind, can find a way out into things which are not yet established, there cannot be a radical change in humanity. And in this paragraph that we read, he uses an interesting term. He says, up till now, what nature has achieved
Debashista, are you in mute? Oh no.
Okay. So, as I was saying, he's using this term, the knowledge ignorance. Elsewhere, he has used this interesting term to talk about the overmind. Because the overmind represents the transition from the knowledge to the ignorance, or vice versa. It is the transition of consciousness, the limit of mind. But here he seems to be referring to more what he calls the surface knowledge ignorance. In other words, a twilight zone in which knowledge and ignorance are mixing on the surface of our nature. Now, if this is to change and we are to abolish the ignorance, as he says, what it attempted in the spiritual endeavor is to abolish the ignorance, as in this paragraph, we can see that this has happened in certain cases. And that's why he's using the past tense there, what it attempted in the spiritual endeavor. In other words, nature itself has exceeded that scope in the past in certain instances. These are the spiritual instances that he has spoken of earlier, two paragraphs back, where he says, where he said, you know, that sentence towards the end of the two paragraphs back, where he's talking about the spiritual man is her supreme supernormal effort of human creation. For having evolved the mental creator, thinker, sage, prophet of an ideal, the self-controlled, self-disciplined, harmonized mental being, she has tried to go higher and deeper within and call out into the front the soul and inner mind heart, call down from above the forces of the spiritual mind and higher mind and over mind, and create under their light and by their influence the spiritual sage, seer, prophet, god lover, yogin, gnostic, sufi, mystic. So these examples of the past achievements of nature, which, as Sri Aurobindo says, sort of always exceeds her normal scope by creating sort of pilot forays into the future, have been that kind of attempt to break the bounds of our normal humanity. But what he doesn't sort of bring to the front in this paragraph, but what is implied in it, is that whatever nature has established so far becomes a kind of a established faith in the species. And if we are to actually break the bounds, it can come either through individual sporadic efforts of some person or the other. It will always remain sporadic until and unless there is breaking of the bonds is something that can only come in the large mass when nature takes that turn. And so, in fact, he's actually ending the paragraph by saying, this is the, and even where he's talking about the breaking, the changing from knowledge ignorance, he's talking about nature rather than the individual. Though he's saying that the evolution first, because the individual has to take the lead. But still nature is involved. It is a transition from nature to the individual that is this particular stage of movement. What it attempted in the spiritual endeavor is to abolish the ignorance, to go inwards and discover the soul, and to become united in consciousness with God and with all existence. This is the final aim of the mental stage of evolutionary nature in man. It is the initial step towards a radical transmutation of the ignorance into the knowledge. The spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind. In other words, the impetus has to come, whether in the individual or in the race, in the mass, by some action from within. And that is really a a change begins, a kind of a new wave, the crest of a new wave that enters into our lives and begins calling to rise to another level. So that influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind must come. And in fact, this is part of the reason why Sri Aurobindo arrived at the need to bring down the supermind. Because this influence can come in a variety of dilute ways through any kind of access to higher ranges of consciousness and a bringing of their influence into our nature. But it is only the supermental that can have an enduring influence, that can have a transforming influence on nature. So the influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind may become active, and no doubt today it is active in world nature, one may say, but that also has to be accepted, and it has to translate itself into a change of faith, into a need to live that life that it brings. And he's making a very deep point over here, which is that once that influence is felt, it can stop short, because but this by itself can lead only to an illumined mental idealism or to the growth of a religious mind, a religious temperament, and some devotion in the heart and piety in the conduct. It is a first approach of mind to spirit, but it cannot make a radical change. More has to be done. We have to live deeper within. We have to exceed our present consciousness and surpass our present status of nature. So this need, where it goes beyond just a spiritual idealism, an illumined mental idealism, which is in a sense what we can see all around us. Not even a spiritual, what is an illumined mental idealism, can be seen as the so-called new age, which is all around us. You know, the need for vegetarianism, the need for, you know, developing various modes of consciousness, the dabbling in the occult, all these kinds of things are effects of a idealism, an illumined idealism, which is only affecting the surface, but doesn't call on us to change our nature or live in a higher consciousness. On the other hand, you find the other effect, which is a widespread religiosity.
Chapter 18.
So this is one of the issues that he's bringing to the forefront, that firstly, this has to be the change that takes place in human nature. This change has nature in the mass, an evolutionary change, that it has to be individualized in the human, that it can come to a certain action or influence of the inner and the higher being, but there has to be a point where the individual actually feels the urge, the aspiration for a change of existence. And that is related to a change of faith, related to a faith in the fact that it is possible and necessary for our modality of knowledge to change. It is not enough to Aurobindo is talking about the transition as a transition from the mental consciousness, though he uses the term deeper, and later he will talk about the soul. The emphasis here seems to be a change from the mental to the inner and higher mind consciousness ranges, rather than an entry into the psychic. Now this may be because a lot of this was written at a time when Sri Aurobindo, following his own trajectory of yoga, which took him, you know, first into the higher mind ranges, spiritual mind ranges, And then, as he points out in Ashwapati's Yoga and Savitri, the transition is first into all the ranges of the mind, right up to what he calls the knowledge ignorance. In other words, ranges of the overmind, where mind itself is seen as a kind of only an arbitrary representation, meaning ceases. And then he enters into the psychic world, and develops a sense of meaning, you know, the imminent or the deeper dimension of reality. So here too, the whole emphasis is on the ascent of consciousness, moving from mind to the ranges beyond it, higher, rather than into the psychic being, which elsewhere he seems to prioritize, and particularly later, he seems to prioritize as the first step.
So, Devashishda,
yes.
So, when you say, so he prioritizes in a different place the psychic being, and here the trend seems to be that he wants to go to the higher ranges of the mind. So, but then,
Sorry. Yes, I missed what you had to ask. I got cut off in the middle of your question.
Yeah. So I was what I was trying to get at was the reader or the so how does one focus the aspiration given the different demands on in different places, right? Is it more that you fix your aspiration on a certain aspect which you are drawn to, or is it, because otherwise it can become quite a, you know, haphazard exercise, correct?
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, that is where the whole issue of Swadharma comes in. We all begin somewhere, and that beginning is dependent on where, as he says, it has to begin. The spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind, an action felt and accepted on the surface. So it's a question of where that action begins. In this particular case, of course, in the teaching of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, as it developed, finally, there is an emphasis on trying to focus on the psychic being and bring it forward. But even that may need some other kind of beginning. A certain degree of quiet in the mind, a certain degree of surrender of the vital. So, where it begins, in this particular case, in the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo is seeing the whole ascent as an ascent of consciousness which is evolutionary and has reached the consciousness of mind. And in several places he makes the sort of, point that man as he is constituted right now is primarily a mental being. Now, the psychic being can be more truly said to be the essence of the human, but we don't have that much access to it because it is so deep within. However, the mind itself has got its own ranges, and through contact with the inner mind, ultimately we can rise to a different kind of knowing. And this is what he is pointing out over here. Our aspiration for the divine may begin differently. It may be an aspiration for knowledge. And an aspiration for knowledge has to arrive at a certain, a kind of a need to know things differently from the ignorant way in which we know things right now. It can't be sufficient to us. This form of knowledge that we have, if we feel that it is not sufficient, that there is a boundary to break, that the inner and outer, the subjective and objective distance, gulf, can be broken. That initiates us into this way that he's pointing out over here, which is a way of a systematic rise to higher modalities of knowledge, of knowing, through the mind itself, through exceeding or breaking the boundaries that we have at present.
Thank you, Vivekananda.
The Bhashita, I think in a previous discussion sometime back, we were talking about, maybe it was Buddhism, that the dictum is that you should know only what you need for your progress. You don't have to collect a lot of knowledge.
Yeah, that is, I think we were discussing that in the sense that how the Indian knowledge systems have developed. Indian knowledge systems are practical. In other words, the whole terminology, the vocabulary, the relationship between the various terms and the description of reality that is given to us is related to the goal. And the goal is connected to a question which is being answered. That is the need, so to say. So, for example, in Buddhism, the need is what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for the eradication of suffering. Now, questions or terms or descriptions of reality that exceed this answer, the answer to this question, are not seen as germane to it. So there are a variety of knowledge systems that are like that. But then also Sri Aurobindo's view is that the question of integrality is one that will automatically put us into contact with an integral knowledge, a knowledge that has to take into its ambit all the terms of consciousness, but only primary terms as they are related, so that we can arrive at an integral knowledge.
So coming back to Shyam's question, is it advisable to seek out different paths of knowledge, like try to learn some occultism and then do some Sufi mysticism and then learn some Buddhism?
Gosh.
And all that?
No, certainly I don't think he's trying to make that kind of a point. What he's saying, as I mentioned, is that the action of the inner mind or the action of the inner consciousness, which is basically the occult pressure, yes, so which is the occult pressure felt by us, is what we need to follow. This whole thing about Swadharma is not something we need to bother about, but still we need to be sincere to our aspiration. That is ultimately the question or the point. The aspiration begins somewhere. With our mind, we cannot, you know, dabble in a variety of things. You know, there may be so many different methods and practices and all that kind of thing. But if there is a sincerity to the aspiration, then that will guide us to what we need to do. And that is individual. That is customized. It is different for every individual.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Keka, do you want to read?
Sorry, my microphone was muted. So it is evident that, right?
Yeah.
It is evident that if we can live thus deeper within, and put out steadily the inner forces into the outer instrumentation, or raise ourselves to dwell on higher and wider levels and bring their powers to bear on physical existence. Not merely, should I continue or should I wait?
Yeah, you can continue.
Not merely receive influences descending from them, which is all we can now do. There could begin a heightening of our force of conscious being, so as to create a new principle of consciousness, a new range of activities, new values for all things, a widening of our consciousness and life, a taking up and transformation of the lower grades of our existence. In brief, the whole evolutionary process by which the spirit in nature creates a higher type of being. Each step would mean a pace, however distant from the goal, or a close approach leading to a larger and more divine being, a larger and more divine force and consciousness, knowledge and will, sense of existence and delight in existence. There could be an initial unfolding towards the divine life, all religion, all occult knowledge, all supernormal as opposed to abnormal psychological experience, all yoga, all psychic experience and discipline are signposts and directions pointing us upon that road of progress of that occult self-unfolding spirit.
So, as we see, he is calling upon us to live in another consciousness. It is evident that if we can live thus deeper within and put out steadily the inner forces into the outer instrumentation, or raise ourselves to dwell on higher and wider levels and bring their powers to bear on physical existence, not merely receive influences descending from them, which is all we can do now, there could be a heightening of our force of conscious being, so as to create a new principle of consciousness. So we are receiving influences descending from these higher ranges. This is going on all the time. It's into our inner being, there is an influence that is coming. We may be completely oblivious of it. It may be doing its work behind the veil. We may be partially aware of it. We may be inspired by it at certain times. But nevertheless, it's an invisible action. It's the action of the Shakti behind the veil. But if we can actually dwell in these ranges, that is, if we can take our residence either within, deep in the inner being, or become completely psychicized, or if we can take our station above the mind, as he says over here, either the higher mind or levels beyond that, then there can be a beginning of a new principle of consciousness. And from that station, one can actually bring, as he says, the inner forces into the outer instrumentation. It becomes a conscious process. Now, this conscious process is what is being done in an occult way by universal nature. So he says, in brief, the whole evolutionary process by which the spirit in nature creates a higher type of being. So this is the process. When this process can become conscious in us, we can participate in it and become the creators of this process.
Because in the human being, the Purusha is active. We are not merely prakritic beings, but the reversal of consciousness he's talking about is for the soul, the Purusha, to become the leader of the march, to become the controller of the prakritic forces. So this then he sees in terms of levels and rungs of ascent. And as each step could mean a pace, however distant from the goal, or a close approach leading to a larger and more divine being, larger and more divine force and consciousness, knowledge and will, sense of existence and delight in existence. This is also the notion of an unending progress. Unending progress in levels of consciousness. In most other schools or most other forms of yoga, there is the sense of quote-unquote enlightenment. In other words, you reach somewhere to another level of consciousness and that is where you stop. Of course, there are other schools that talk about unending progress. Even in Zen Buddhism, there is the notion of successive satoris. Each satori is a stage of freedom, a plateau of enlightenment. But the satori has to lead to others beyond it. So in that sense, this is like that, in that once we go within or rise above, we come to a certain stable sort of possession of consciousness, but it cannot be the stopping point. It has to be a point where we actually make some kind of an established foundation and then move on to something else. So this range, this succession of the ability to go within or go above and transform the nature from there. You see, we talk about the triple transformation. So it is similar. Each range of consciousness is then brought into the nature and made to transform the nature. That is the integration that takes place. And then we move to a higher range and then effect a transformation from there. So this is what he's talking about. And all the possible methods that have been developed can be grist to our mill. That's why he says all religion, all occult knowledge, all supernormal psychological experience, all yoga, all psychic experience and discipline are signposts and directions upon the road of progress of the occult self unfolding spirit.
So talking of this unending journey, Devashishtha, so do we know, for example, before 1956, we know that the establishment of the supramental on earth was the specific goal that the Mother and Sri Aurobindo were trying to accomplish. But do we know what it is that the Mother was doing afterward, that is the transformation in the physical, that there would have been a definite end had she continued, that this would have been over and then she would start something else?
Yes, the Mother was trying to do that work of transformation of the physical using the supramental forces. She was trying to create a supramental body. The descent of the supramental and the existence in the supramental consciousness is something that both Sri Aurobindo and the Mother were in the process of establishing. The Siddhi of the overmind had been fully established. The transformation of the nature in the overmental consciousness had taken place. Now the thing is that the supramental consciousness had been entered into. They had both resided in it, and then that particular consciousness had been brought down in a universal way. And then it was being individualized as a kind of a form, a sort of inner form, inner mental, inner vital, inner physical form by the Mother. And ultimately she was projecting it into the actual physical, the physical, to whatever extent the cellular consciousness would take it. This would was going to be the foundation from which he would actually radiate it into the physical of the earth. So that is the process that was going on, because the integration of the supramental consciousness in an individual is only the prelude to its actual establishment as a sort of a universal physical transformation. That is what she was working towards. Now, if that is established, that's why he has made the point again and again that once the supramental manifestation can be anchored in a race on earth, in a Gnostic race on earth, that there is established the new species, then there is the movement towards the next rung or stage of manifestation, the next sort of consciousness and its manifestation, its integration, which is basically the Anandamaya consciousness, the consciousness of the delight consciousness, the play of Ananda on earth. But the supermind is the basis of the transition from the ignorance to the knowledge, the crossing over the boundaries of what he calls the knowledge ignorance in that previous paragraph.
Nibhashita, is Krishna the Anandamaya Purusha also?
Yes.
So the Siddhi that Sri Aurobindo had in 1926, 24th November, is that bringing down the Anandamaya in the physical or in his body?
No, that is bringing down the overmind consciousness in the physical. As he has made the point, Krishna originates in the Anandamaya plane, but he comes down into the overmind and leads it. So the avatar Krishna is really operating from the overmind, though his real station is beyond in the Anandamaya. So when he's talking about the Krishna fixing himself in his body, he's talking about the overmental Purusha as the delegate of Krishna, as Krishna acting through the overmind that is establishing itself in his body. Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yes, Rakesh.
When we talk about Anandamaya plane, this Anandamaya plane is everywhere, right? And in all the Purusha stages.
Yes. That the entire Satchidananda everywhere. But it has its own station. That's why the Vedas talk about Swedhami. So that is the Swadham, the kind of its original station, its own home, which is essentially above the ignorance in the knowledge. And so you have to look at these things both in a universal sense and in a transcendental sense. So from the universal point of view, everything is an extension of Satchidananda. And Satchidananda can be contacted at any plane. Universal Purusha can be contacted at any plane. But if you want to contact overmental being, Anandamaya Purusha in his own home, that is only above the supermind.
So Lord Krishna, the original plane is that. So it
yes.
is not anywhere, is it not in the, it is not the Anandamaya plane on the supermind?
No, that Anandamaya plane is also present on the supermind. That's a very good point
yeah,
to make, because each of these has their own access. Yes.
Because when we talk about planes above supermind, they talk about Purusha and Prakriti together, and it is called the Mother Divine, right? We cannot differentiate between all these Satchitananda. It is all, he says it is Purusha. Which is acting to be, so he calls that as the Mother Divine, right?
Yeah, you can say that Purusha, Mother Divine, Mother Para Prakriti is united with Supreme Purusha, Purushottama. Purushottama and Para Prakriti are in union. they are differentiated for the means, for any manifestation, they need to differentiate themselves. It's a self-differentiation.
I have something to say, a question basically. So when we are talking about this supramental transformation and things like that, is it possible to look at it this way, that real problem is death? Like if death can be conquered, in the reverse order, every one of us has some kind of fear, and main fear is death, right? Like we are running out of our time. So we have to do something within that time, things like that. So that day I was looking at the internet, surfing a little bit, and I was looking at the meaning of that Mahamrityu Nijaya mantra, and that refers to Shiva, worshipping Lord Shiva. So, as if Lord Shiva, all gods are the same, but that is the image that Mahamrityunjaya mantra is looking at to conquer death. So, can you comment a little bit between this Lord Shiva, the conquering death, and the supramental transformation, these all three together?
Actually, that is a very profound point. The point about death, in some sense, being the kind of crux of the matter, and that's why Sri Aurobindo has taken that particular topic in Savitri. The whole of Savitri is geared towards the conquest of death. Now, the conquest of death, understanding it, one is, we actually are afraid of non-being. We are afraid of the disappearance of individuality, and we are afraid of the disappearance of consciousness, complete disappearance of consciousness. So the physical form, the disappearance of the physical form is something secondary, but that is also a certain kind of a problem. Now, the overcoming of death firstly is achieved in the ignorance through the realization of the psychic being. The psychic being gives us access to that in us which persists from life to life. A full dwelling or living in the psychic being means that one will consciously live a continuity between life to life beyond through death. That is one thing. But there is also a conquest of death in a higher sense, which is the conquest of death through the experience of immortality in the higher planes. If we know that death is just a kind of a mechanism, but that our existence is a supreme consciousness that does not get in any way modified by death, that is the higher conquest over death. Or one may say the second conquest over death. Second conquest over death is the experience of the Satchidananda, or not just the realization of the Satchidananda or any of its planes. If one realizes the supramental being, or one realizes the Ananda Maya Purusha, one realizes the Chin Maya Purusha or Sat Purusha, there is a access to a certain immortal status to which the mutations of birth and death mean nothing, you see. So that is an immortality. From that point of view, one may say Shiva is really the Sat Purusha in his highest station. Now, Sri Aurobindo points out that all these Purushas, you say Vishnu, Shiva, Brahma, they operate in the overmind and also in the lower ranges below the overmind. But particularly these three, the Trimurti, actually belong to the Vidya, the knowledge worlds. That is, their home is in the supermind and then even beyond the supermind. So we find the Mahamrityunjaya mantra is referring to that status of Shiva, where he can take us beyond our limitation to the ignorance and to the process of birth and death. Now, a third conquest of death is the bringing down of this immortality into nature, that is that integration or transformation, a supramental transformation ultimately will give us a divine body, a body which can consciously renew itself. You know, as he says, you know, the condition of a physical immortality is to be reborn perpetually in time. It is not going to be a fixed body. It will be a body which we consciously cause to die and be reborn from moment to moment. That power is achieved only when the supramental transformation is brought into the physical. So my sense about the Mahamrityunjaya mantra is that it refers to the second status of immortality, where one develops permanent consciousness above due to a certain station, taking a station in eternity, which will not be affected by the processes of the mutations of birth and death.
Thank you.
The pure Advaitin should not have a big issue with death, no? Because they anyway don't believe in existence.
Yes, but they also don't believe in any persistence of the consciousness. They believe in merging with the eternal consciousness. So, in a sense, just like the Buddhist believes in the extinction of being, the Advaitin believes in the extinction of consciousness. Being remains, but it is no longer one's own being. The consciousness has merged into something which, you know, doesn't have any individual existence anymore. But there may be a bolder sort of liberation above, where one retains one's individuality and yet one is beyond the processes of death and birth.
And this is what the Mahamrityunjaya mantra also says.
I am surmising.
Okay.
This is what, for example, the Isha Upanishad is talking about regarding the two forms of immortality. Knowing the ignorance, one can pass beyond death, and knowing the knowledge, one can attain to immortality. So, the first one is the knowledge of the psychic being, which in the ignorance causes us to pass beyond death.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is the station, individual station in the higher consciousness, in the Satchidananda, whereby one can know immortality, know that permanent consciousness that is not affected by the processes of death and birth. However, the third step, which is actually bringing that consciousness into the physical, is not addressed there. Now, whether the Mahamrityunjaya mantra also carries that sense or not, I'm not sure. It could be, because it is a Vedic mantra, after all, that sense was also there in it. That Shiva's power was being invoked for a transformation of the physical. But I'm not sure. I don't have any ability to, you know whether that was the case. Now, talking about Shiva, there is a very interesting passage by the mother which relates to the time that the overmental descent took place and Sri Aurobindo had his siddhi. If you remember, the mother talks about that period as the period when all the gods were coming down, and she says that Shiva also came down to her and that he offered her a boon, and she said that she wanted the dissolution of the body at that point. And she also asked him to descend and become established in the earth consciousness. And apparently he refused. He said he would only come after the supramental manifestation was established. And he also apparently gave her that boon that she asked for, which is the so-called dissolution of the body. Now, exactly what that means, I really don't know. But she goes on to say that she went to Sri Aurobindo and said that she had been given this boon. And Sri Aurobindo withdrew the boon. He said, not yet. and she got back again the consciousness of the body, which had been in some sense dissolved due to the wound by Shiva. She talks about this in the agenda.
Where exactly is this conversation, do you know?
It is, I think it's in Agenda Volume 2, where she is talking about that's where she is talking about the events that occurred in 1926. In November, and also about the establishment of Krishna in Sri Aurobindo physically. At the same time, talk about this experience with Shiva at that point.
The place where I was looking at this meaning of this mantra. It's on the on the internet. Lord Shiva is the three-eyed god. Shiva is always perfumed. He fosters all the creatures of the universe. Lord Shiva releases from death for the sake of immortality, as cucumber detaches its bondage of the vine. We worship Lord Shiva to liberate us from death.
Sorry, I was muted. Yes, I remember that. Yeah, it says that Uruva Rukamiva Pantanat, that is, just as the cucumber is severed from the creeper, the cucumber is connected to the creeper, you sever the cucumber from the creeper, so we are connected to death as a bondage. It's a complex image. So, the severing would actually give us some sort of sense as if we are being cut from something, but that image refers to our bondage to death. So, my sense is, again, you see, as you're saying in that passage, severing our bondage to death is what it is talking about. In other words, so long as we are under the spell of death, death has its control over us. We are under bondage to death. But by the grace of Shiva, this Mahamrityunjaya mantra, we can rise to a level of consciousness in which the processes of birth and death do not bind us anymore. See, the Upanishads are constantly talking about going beyond the cycles of rebirth. But that has been interpreted as meaning that we should escape from the round of rebirth, not be reborn anymore. However, it can also be interpreted as meaning that we are beyond the sort of processes of rebirth. In other words, by choice we can be reborn, by choice we can die. Mm-hmm. See, by choice we can regenerate ourselves. So to be free of the bondage to death is what that mantra is talking about. And from that point of view, it is really the issue is one of not being under the control of the processes of birth and death.
And there is somewhere that maybe it's in the agenda that Mother has talked about birth in the supramental creation, where people will not be born in the present state of helplessness. Is that true?
She's talking about being born by conscious process. In other words, by taking a body through the through the control of the elements, material elements. That is self-projection in matter.
Like that, Narada in Savitri?
like Narada and Savitri, he comes down and he takes on a form. Now, you know, and Sri Aurobindo also says that you know, our mother says, Sri Aurobindo said, I will come back in the first supramental body, built in the supramental way. And later she explains the same kind of thing, that he will not be subject to the processes of birth that normal human beings are subject to. He will control his own birth. In other words, he will just appear by the control of the elements. Yes.
And these are also the images that are used in the Puranas, like Brahma created the Prajapatis with his mental power, or Manasputras.
Yes, there's also the idea of Swayambhu, self-becoming, in the physical sense, ultimately. Maybe Shiva, you see, in the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, maybe it is a power given to Shiva, because traditionally, the notion of Swayambhu is related to the appearance of lingas by themselves. And, you know, the whole notion of what is called Jyotirlinga is that there are places where lingas have just suddenly appeared by themselves. So that physical reappearance is connected with a power by which this transcendental being has materialized itself.
I mean, is it possible for it to have anything to do with the whether being is first or becoming is first?
Yes, being is first, no doubt. And being enters into the process of becoming by its own power. That is that what you said, being becoming is the original creation sort of process that is repeated again and again, way, for example, in the Nasadiya Sukta, the Veda, again in the Upanishad, by his own power he became. That is how they put it. He was invisible to himself, by his own power he became.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is not an event that takes place at some time zero, but as Sri Aurobindo points out somewhere, there are certain events that are eternal events. They have never happened in time, but they vibrate eternally as something that is, you know, that's the only way the paradox of which came first can be overcome.
So, is there any mention anywhere about the fact that becoming came before being? Since there is a paradox, that means there is a way of seeing both ways, and then there is a way of seeing it synthetically.
Yeah, see, the tantric view is that. The tantric view, that is why it prioritizes the Divine Mother, though she is inseparable from the Lord. Yet she stands atop the Lord. So basically, she comes first. She is prioritized. You know, in the tantric experience, it will say that the mother, who is the supreme power, and again, the whole question about para prakriti and purushottam, the question is, it is possible to see para prakriti as supreme, as the power of becoming that is original.
But even in tantric way of worship, they ultimately the power has rise and unite to Shiva, right?
Yes. Now that
so,
is the.
The liberation
that
is only obtained after power reaches Shiva. So Shiva is like is the Purusha who is above Prakriti. He's detached. I mean, he has control over nature, so.
Yeah, but this nature is one with Shiva. So in the supreme nature, the para prakriti is no different from Purushottam. So it's only here that we have the notion of control. There is no control. It is spontaneously. That's why this, in the supermind, he is talking about knowledge dash will. Knowledge will. Knowledge and will are not two different things. It is not that the one knows by identity and then the nature acts as the will. The knowledge and the will are one thing. So if we look at it from our point of view, we can prioritize either of them. See, Sri Ramakrishna, that's the whole thing. He went for the Advaitic realization. And then his conclusion after he came back from that realization was that, you know, I don't know if you know that whole story about Sri Ramakrishna and his Advaitic realization. He couldn't go beyond the entire range of the manifestation because Kali was appearing to him again and again. And
yeah,
finally she offers the sword for him to cut her head. And he does it and then he enters into the state of liberation. But when he came back, he was asked his experience and he said, my conclusion is that there is no place where the Divine Mother is not there. That even beyond, it is only she who is there. So basically he had that experience of the para prakriti as the supreme being, whether within or outside of the ignorance.
Right. I mean, yeah, you cannot separate them any, I mean,
you cannot separate.
Because even Sri Aurobindo, I was reading those old, he says that instead of, you know, trying to take, you know, keeping Sita and Rama in different places, and it is better to worship Sita to, you know, show a way to Rama so that Sita can, instead of trying to force and separate and find Rama, it is much better to worship Sita and ask her the way to Rama, you know?
Yes, yes.
Something like that.
Yes, that's why in Sri Aurobindo's case, again, it is the same. Power of becoming is the Divine Mother. And as you can see in the book, the Mother, she is the Supreme. You know, the Supreme Being is carried by her. And there's a place where the Mother is asked, you know, what is the relationship between the Mother and Shiva? I remember this one. Champaklal asks, what is the relationship? Yes. Sorry. Yeah, so that question actually is of central importance in a way to Sri Aurobindo's yoga, because as he points out repeatedly, here the reliance on the mother is primary. Why? Because she is the power of becoming. One can arrive at a certain kind of a, you know, consciousness of identity with existence, with being, but that does not transform. So to rely on the power of becoming is from its supreme heights is what allows the process to establish itself. As he says, she can prepare the being and she can rend the veil and she can pour into us, into the Adhara, as he says in the Mother, the higher consciousness and make us into that particular, you know, mold us into that particular sort of, you know, I mean, formation, instrumentation that can embody and manifest the supreme consciousness. So power of the mother, power of becoming in its higher station is what becomes central to the process of transformation.
Right. I mean, I was also thinking, like, because most of the time we are in lower nature and even the, you know, Atman or silence, we say it is detached from the nature and it doesn't take part in his transformation. So we need the,
yes,
what they say, the Mother Divine to because she is the conscious force, and when you pray to her, she can come down and try to change your lower nature, something like that.
Yes. This is where, in a sense, Sri Aurobindo has reversed some of the traditional, you see, because Vedantic tradition, Vedic and Vedantic, of course, he has drawn on that too and pointed to the goddesses, pointed to Aditi, etc. But if you look at the entire Vedic texts, there has been revision of these texts. The whole Savitri, he's pointing out, has come from the Veda, but it is not in the Veda now. So too, the goddesses are given a relatively lower role in the Veda now. And so, in a sense, there has been a revisioning that has taken place. And in that sense, he has turned the whole thing, given the highest priority to the Divine Mother, to bring about a divine creation in the ignorance, to transform the ignorance.
Window stuck. Are we dumping? Window is stuck actually, our machine is stuck.
You control all day.
Shall we do one more?
Yes.
Paragraph?
Yes. Yes, we can do. Meera, do you want to read?
Yeah, I can read. But the human race is still weighted by a certain gravitation towards the physical. It obeys still the pull of our yet unconquered earth matter. It is dominated by the brain mind, the physical intelligence, thus held back by many ties. It hesitates before the indication or falls back before the too dense demand of the spiritual effort. It has too still a great capacity for skeptical folly, an immense indolence, an enormous intellectual and spiritual timidity and conservatism when called out of the grooves of habit. Even the constant evidence of life itself, that where it chooses to conquer, it can conquer, witness the miracles of that quite inferior power, physical science, does not prevent it from doubting. It repels the new call and leaves the response to a few individuals. But that is not enough if the step forward is to be for humanity. For it is only if the race advances that for it the victories of the spirit can be secure. For then, even if there is a lapse of nature, a fall in her effort, the spirit within, employing a secret memory, sometimes represented on the lower side, that of downward gravitation, as an atavistic force in the race, but really the force of a persistent memory in nature, which can pull us either upward or downward, will call it upward again, and the next ascent will be both easier and more lasting, because of the past endeavor. For that endeavor and its impulse and its result cannot but remain stored in the subconscious mind of humanity. Who can say what victories of the kind may have been achieved in our past cycles, and how near may be the next ascension? It is not indeed necessary or possible that the whole race should transform itself from mental into spiritual beings, but a general admission of the ideal, a widespread endeavor, a conscious concentration are needed to carry the stream of tendency to its definitive achievement. Otherwise, what will be ultimately accomplished is an achievement by the few initiating a new order of beings, while humanity will have passed sentence of unfitness on itself and may fall back into an evolutionary decline or a stationary immobility. For it is the constant upward effort that has kept humanity alive and maintained for it its place in the front of creation.
This is a very powerful paragraph where he's making that call for the whole of humanity, for the race in general, and the necessity for it to make the attempt to arise to the aspiration of a changed consciousness, of a higher consciousness. And he's pointing to the problems. Again, as I mentioned, it is really a problem of a change of faith. It is the fact that we are so stuck in what we already are and so refuse any other possibility, even if we see that there are certain instances where it has been achieved. He points to a variety of things there, the many ties, he says. He says, firstly, there is the two-tenths demand of the spiritual effort. There's a sense that it is too much. It's not for us, or it's not in this life, or it's only after a lot of meandering that we will be ready for it. You know, it's Saint Augustine has a line where he says, "Take from me, something, but not yet." You see. So it is as if we'd like to go there, but most of us doesn't want to go there now. And then he points to this, the problems that stand in the way, a great capacity for skeptical folly. You know, so skepticism is actually a foolishness, much of it. And that is, you know, the mind has a great capacity for that. An immense indolence, that's the laziness. We don't want to move, the tamas of our present consciousness. An enormous intellectual and spiritual timidity and conservatism. That is, we don't have the courage or the boldness, and we want to stick because we then take comfort in numbers. Everybody around us is like this, so you know, nobody is going to call us out of our present indolence, as he points out, when called out of the grooves of habit. And then he points to the fact that constantly man has exceeded himself. Even the victories of science are proof of the fact of how life has always achieved whatever it has put its faith in. See, wherever it has chosen to conquer, it has conquered. And yet, we will not, you know, sort of admit this, but there is a need for it, and that's the, you know, eloquence of the rest of the paragraph is that we see Sri Aurobindo taking the trouble to write these wonderful words because he felt that many people should read it and feel a wide aspiration in humanity to exceed itself, to bring about a change in humanity. And that's why he's saying over here that even if the attempt is made at some point and it doesn't succeed, still it remains in the subconscious mind of humanity. And if not today, then tomorrow, by natural force, it will again revive its impetus. This is how he has also talked about his own effort to bring down the supermind. He says, even if I knew for sure by a higher knowledge that it cannot be done now, still I would do exactly what I am doing because it would. So, yeah, as he says over there, who can say what victories of the kind may have been achieved in our past cycles and how near may be the next ascension? And of course, there is a hint here of the Vedic age, where, as he says, we move actually not in a kind of a sort of ascent from some primitive condition to a fulfilled condition, but from a condition in which already the achievement in a seed form begins our ascent to its general realization. So some people, the Vedic rishis, the seers, have already made the attempt, and that is already vibrating in the subconscious mind of man. And its hour may have come now. This is the point that he's trying to make over here. And then, even if the whole of humanity cannot achieve this, if there are substantial numbers that make the effort towards what he has called a divine life, a wholesale, a kind of a collective ascent to a living in a new consciousness, a higher consciousness, then yes. So that is the call that he's making over here, that in a way it has to be a kind of a general admission of the ideal. And for that to happen, of course, Sri Aurobindo has been very careful to point out that we should not proselytize, that this is not a propagandist effort by which this can be made into a general aspiration, but that, you know, the kind of high consciousness and aspiration present in works like this, if it can be made available, Mother uses the phrase to lay the table. If the table can be, there is a great need for that, a great need to make the call or to issue the call, to have that call be issued, which they have already issued in all their works. To the extent that can, you know, enter into the consciousness of a wide range of humanity, this possibility is then made active. Otherwise, it will only be a kind of a caucus, a small group that can, as he says, initiate a new order of beings that will be like a secret order, like some kind of Gnostic community that cordons itself off from the rest of humanity. But humanity will be left, as he says, will have passed sentence of unfitness on itself and may fall back into an evolutionary decline or a stationary immobility. Here also, it's very prescient and powerful because the mother has also commented about this as a certain possibility of the future. She says that the human race is a transitioning race. And in the ultimate analysis, it may not even remain. What may happen is that it may split, and a certain class of humanity may be absorbed into the animal. We may kind of have an animal humanity, much more crude and animal-like, and on the other hand, the rest will pass into a superhumanity. She has seen this as one possibility, which is like the one he's talking about, an evolutionary decline. Or on the other hand, he's talking about a stationary immobility, because as she's pointed out, that the very essence of the human consciousness is one of evolution. It cannot remain stagnant, for it is the constant upward effort that has kept humanity alive. We can't even remain alive unless that aspiration is constantly moving forward and maintained for it its place in the front of the creation.
The mention of memory reminds one of the first paragraph of the Life Divine, the earliest preoccupation of man.
Yes, yes. There again, he is pointing to the fact that it is the Vedic seers who have actually laid down, in a sense, the whole map of the future of humanity. And one place he's saying, it's the rishis of the Veda who have given to India its being. India has been created, shaped by the rishis. And by that he means that the whole future trajectory of India has been given its form by the aspirations and achievements of the Vedic rishis. Again, for the same reason, because they have planted it in the subconscious mind, in the depths of the Indian consciousness, this particular effort that they have initiated, which cannot be wiped out. We can go into all kinds of obfuscations and meanderings, but that has too much power to be wiped out in time.
Hello, Debashish Mahesh. Able to hear me?
Yes, Mahesh. Yes.
You know, I just wanted to share with you and the group something I ran into. It's a movement with the name of transhumanism, and it's actually, if you just Google the word transhumanism, it's very interesting because it's amazing how the ideals are very similar to what Sri Aurobindo and the mother have put forth, but here what they're doing is through biological, it's basically genetic modification and all those things to create a superior species, and without the kind of defects that come up with the typical you know, human. And so it's basically like fine tuning the human being not to have you know, the kind of mortality that we see, you know, physical perfection as well as psychological perfection, you know, no anger and this and that. So it's another angle on how this new you know, technology and all these things might bring this about. So the question is whether the effort involved in evolving oneself is purely through psychological means or through possibly such intervention as genetics.
Well, this question was raised last time, in fact, and you see, the thing is that, yeah, I'm familiar with the movement called transhumanism, and essentially it is definitely the action of this same aspiration that we talked about earlier, where he's talking about the spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind. But you see, at the same time, what we find is that this cannot actually endure unless there is a change of consciousness. We can have all kinds of genetic mutations, we can use technology to create a better condition for humanity on the surface, but, you know, a faulted consciousness, however much machinery it may use, cannot create perfection. Unless the consciousness has tasted of perfection, you cannot bring about perfection. You can bring about various kind of approximations, and you'll actually enter into a... To complete the thought about the transhuman movement and this kind of genetic, we discussed this last time. And the fact is that, you know, when the genome project began, there was the hope that we'd be disease-free by the time we mapped the human genome. But this has not happened because this is even to get rid of cancer. Not just one particular...
Yeah, just to wanted to interrupt. Just to let you know that Mahesh is no more online. So I mean, we would definitely like to hear it, but in case you want to repeat when he comes online, I don't know. Just wanted to